Hello and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your devoted host, and today we're very pleased to have with us Dr. Jillian Isaacs-Russell, who's written a book called Screen Relations, The Limits of Computer-Mediated Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy, published by Carnac in 2015. Welcome, Dr. Isaacs-Russell.
Thank you so much for having me with you. Tracy, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, it's and here we are in a book that contends with Skype and Skype therapy. And I just want everyone to know that Dr. Isaacs-Russell and I are speaking via Skype without the video because I find it way too disorienting and hard to listen to interviewees if I'm looking at them via Skype because I'm unable to make eye contact with them, but I can see them. It's so that's where we begin. Everyone that I interview on the show, I ask them a very simple question, which I'd like to ask you. What prompted the writing of this book?
Right. Well, the inspiration for the research prior to the book and the book that followed came from my own personal experience. Mm-hmm. So my own use of screen relations-based treatment led me to ask questions like, can a highly effective therapeutic process occur without physical co-presence? And this happened because in 2008, I wound down a practice of over two decades and moved from the UK to the Black Hills of South Dakota. Well. And yes, which is a big move in all sorts of ways. And because my stay there was only temporary, I didn't intend to start a practice. And instead, I decided I was going to continue to work on some pieces of speculative fiction that I'd begun in the UK, where I had a psychoanalyst as the protagonist. And speculative fiction begins with the question, what if? And of course, my what ifs at that point grew from my own grappling with separation from family and friends and home territory. So I was asking things like, what if humankind existed spread over remote planets, living in social and cultural isolation, but with advanced technology for instantaneous communication? Or what if an envoy on a remote planet where psychotherapy was incomprehensible or prohibited needed help from a therapist on the home planet? So I did lots of research, which led me through the history of the Nazi regime in relation to psychoanalysis, to the banning of psychoanalysis in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in one of those serendipitous art-life connections, I came upon an intriguing article about CAPA, which is the China-American Psychoanalytic Alliance. And that is a nonprofit organization which was formed to meet the needs of Chinese mental health professionals who wanted to learn more about psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And it proceeded by treating, teaching, and supervising these professionals, all from the West, all on platforms like Skype. And in this article, they were calling for Western volunteers. And they described Skype as very easy. This was in comparatively early days of Skype, that the audio was as good as in the same room, and that the video was crystal clear. And most importantly, it described the treatment as developing exactly as does traditional treatment, that it was indistinguishable. Well, for me, the prospect of being able to teach and treat enthusiastic students of a completely different culture from my own very remote location was highly intriguing. And I really felt that Skype would solve my dilemma of distance and separation and allow me to transcend space and time because the only instruments I would need were myself and my computer. So I downloaded the Skype software and I began my exploration of technologically mediated communication. And at the same time, I also began what finally amounted to about 3 years of meetings with peers who also did technologically mediated treatments in China and elsewhere. And these meetings also occurred on the screen using Skype. Well, as our meetings progressed, instead of talking about the East-West cultural challenges, which we thought we would be doing, we actually became increasingly aware of the effects of the technology itself on our treatments. as you probably know, if you use Skype with any regularity, the audio and video is not normally lifelike and often not crystal clear. It's got poor sound. It often has grainy visuals and frequent interruptions and disconnections. So we really became old hands at calling back several times in sessions, and we learned to turn off the video to increase the bandwidth by just using audio. Then we began to notice anomalies in our behavior. We had curious lapses. It was really easy to forget the times of sessions and of our peer group meeting. It seemed very easy to forget the content of sessions, which was very uncharacteristic for practitioners who were extremely experienced. We were much more casual, more likely to bring a cup of tea or a glass of water into a session. We dressed more casually. We did more talking about comparative times and weather, and more talking in general. We found silences weren't easy, and we felt less in touch. We missed being bodies together, not just with our patients, but with our peer group as well. Mm-hmm. So the colleagues who'd begun remote treatments enthusiastically lost their initial energy. And we asked, how could it be that we had just assumed that co-present treatment would transport seamlessly into technologically mediated treatment? Mm-hmm. So I set out to clarify what happens when we practice technologically mediated treatment. And in fact, what I encountered was an emerging reality which was far more fascinating than any speculative fiction I could imagine. I discovered we're living and practicing in a world of speculative nonfiction. Events in the present day world have led to a series of what ifs, which I've tried to address, that need urgent clarification in the here and now. So since 2012, I've been doing hundreds of hours of ethnographic interviews of clinicians and patients about their experiences with technologically mediated treatment. And I've examined the technologies of mediated communication, how they affect our relationships, how they change not only what we do, but who we are. And I found that eliminating being bodies together largely confines the therapeutic process to what I would call states of mind rather than states of being. And it's only when one can dwell in a state of being that one can take part in the therapeutic process of communicating with oneself and another. So when we add technology to the psychoanalytic mix, and we want to do it responsibly, we need to ask the people who've worked in communication studies, computer science, and technology, you know, long before we entered the mediated scene, right, what impact this addition has had on the nature of close relationships.
Mm-hmm. When reading the book, I found myself very aware of an old question now of Andre Green's whither goeth sexuality in psychoanalysis, at the same time as I was taking up your question, which is, how did analysts sort of think that we could just seamlessly move from two bodies in the room to, you know, the use of the screen? And I began to wonder, as I was reading your book, that question of Green's stayed with me. And I thought, so are analysts at this particular moment, since we have maybe diminished the impact of sexuality in the body in much of psychoanalysis, I wonder if that helped us to just further disembody the experience. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that it's very historic. Freud wrote in a letter to Fleece, I can't quote this exactly, but that he simply didn't know how to go on theoretically and therapeutically, taking into consideration the physicality, taking into consideration the organism rather than just the psychology. Mm-hmm. And he said he didn't know how to begin, and he couldn't fathom why he couldn't do it. And so, I think there is perhaps a history, a heritage of this that started from Freud's feeling baffled about what quite to do with the body and its part in psychoanalysis. And I think from then on, the body has been somewhat sidelined. Certainly in my own training, it was not emphasized. And what I learned about the body and the body's place in the consulting room, I learned in the research, in doing the research for this book, very late on.
Interesting. Right. You really bring the body, the ways in which we communicate with our bodies that we really take for granted. It's not even something we think about. Our bodies are communicating something somehow to another person who's in our presence all the time. And I really appreciated the return of a book that seems to be about technology. It's also really a book about the importance of the body. It could have had a different, I don't know what another title would have been, but it's really the importance of the body in analytic work. I interviewed a while back, a couple years ago, Susie Orbach, and she's, I'm sure, a colleague of yours from England, and she says something more or less like that the body in contemporary culture is no longer a platform on which and through which one's life is lived. The body is attacked via eating derangement, surgery, the quest for perfectibility. And I was thinking about how the screen and screen relations, to some degree, make the body superfluous. And there's a desire for simulacra. But you write, bodies cannot be left out of the equation, though it continues to interest me, and these are your words, that human beings persist in wishing to do so. Mm. Further thoughts? Your very profound statement, I thought, of yours.
I think there's always been this fantasy to rise above the limitations of the body. And that the exciting ability to be able to communicate, and now with computers in our pockets, anytime, anywhere, without having to move our bodies, somehow grants that wish that we don't have limitations, that we aren't tethered to the earth or inside ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's one way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, you think about it, Renee Spitz says that perception begins with the mouth. So that's if you throw that into the mix, and we think that by seeing and, you know, and being on and looking at each other on a screen, that we're perceiving everything. But, you know, how do we begin to perceive our environment as infants with our mouths? That's where how we begin to take it in. So obviously, right then and there, we see the importance of the body for perception. So here's a question for you. I think the book privileges, I think, very much so, a Winnicottian approach to clinical work. And you know, you write about the secure environment, containment, reliable presence. You know, things that are known components of a Winnicottian-based treatment. But I found myself wanting to ask you this. Do you think an analytic approach that's more focused on language, reading the patient and the patient's language as more of a text, of you know, understanding the patient's unconscious through their slips of the tongue, et cetera, would the screen do just as well?
I think that the use of the screen could feel more egosyntonic for someone who was largely focused on language. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that the research being done recently, about what actually does happen in communication between people puts language there in the mix, but also puts what happens between the lines very, very emphatically there as well. So at the risk of sounding quite controversial, I think I might question someone who simply felt they just worked with language in any case. I mean, you know, the neuroscience has had a paradigm shift in the last years from this Cartesian mind-body dualism, when the body is considered peripheral to our understanding of the mind. And all the new research suggests that we think not just with our brains, but with our bodies. Damasio said that our minds are embodied in the full sense of the word, not just embrained. Mm-hmm. And so what goes on in the brain depends on what's going on in the body as a whole and how that body specifically is situated in its environment. So we don't just have states of mind, and we don't just use this reflective verbal position with language. Everything that we do is part of a broader system that critically involves our perception and our action, as I said earlier, our states of being. So whereas language is terribly important, if we look at the work of people like Alan Shore or the Boston Change Process Study Group, you know, what comes up there is the communication that goes on in psychobiological terms in microseconds, not just the language. And that's one of the big things that we're missing when we work in two dimensions, in two different environments, on the screen.
Right, right. I was thinking about, you know, I have patients that are on the phone. I'm more a phone person than a Skype person in that way. But some of those patients, they started off with me in person, and then they moved, and then they come back into town every so often. And so I still get to see them, right? Which is what I prefer. In fact, anytime a patient moves away, I ask if they're willing to fly in once a week, no matter where they move. You're in Switzerland. Can you fly back in once a week so I can see you? And we can continue the other sessions on the phone. I haven't gotten anyone to do that from Switzerland, but But the thing that crossed my mind was, you know, there's different kinds of patients, right? As we know, there's some patients who really, we've had probably both of us patients who begin with us on the phone, you know, in a mediated or via the screen, and that's what they prefer. But when you're working with, let's say, a pre-edible patient, a more primitive regress patient who communicates symbolically, it was painful to think about, and your book put it in stark relief, that how are we able to help that patient and work with that patient via Skype? I mean, what are your thoughts, you know, rather than the more sort of, you know, neurotic patient, the more regressed patient? I mean,
I think if you'd asked me this some months ago, I would have trod very carefully and said, well, it depends, but actually, my feeling is that it's very, very difficult if someone is in that position. And I think that is because you said, I think in Winnicottian terms, it's terribly important that the object to whom that person hopes to relate eventually, you and to use, becomes real in the sense of being part of a shared reality. Mm-hmm. You know, Winnicott would say that the development of the capacity to use an object and feel that object is a separate object it is part of the maturation of the individual in the good enough facilitating environment. And these people need to eventually, hopefully, have the experience that the object is perceived as outside of the subject's omnipotent control.
Right. Right.
And this is impossible if an analysis or therapy is confined to the screen.
Mm-hmm. Right. You can't really destroy an analyst in effigy, right?
No, that's right.
Knowing that the analyst survives the destruction in the room without running out of the room can be key. Actually, you quote Winnicott throughout the book, but there's one quote in particular that I wanted to read. I'm not even sure what this comes from, but it's talking about the facilitating environment. And this is in your chapter on what happens in the consulting room. Winnicott writes, "This work was to be done in a room, not a passage, a room that was quiet and not liable to sudden, unpredictable sounds, yet not dead quiet and not free from ordinary house noises. The room would be lit properly, not by a light staring in the face and not by a variable light. The room would certainly not be dark, and it would be comfortably warm." He's so funny. "The patient would be lying on a couch, that is to say, comfortable if able to be comfortable, and probably a rug and some water would be available." Okay, so you're doing a Skype session with a patient.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've had a patient at the nail salon, right?
You know? Someone in the Atlantic wrote about doing a session with a patient who'd propped their iPhone up on the car dashboard. And yes, what you're talking about is the fact that in two different environments, the patient provides the patient's environment. which is a tremendous departure from what we know is therapeutic for a patient, which is, as Valen says, creating a proper atmosphere for the patient by the analyst. Mm-hmm. And this is something that can't be ensured. And yes, the stories are extreme, and they sound like, oh, well, gosh, that doesn't happen very much. But it does, because people are used to communicating now wherever and whenever. Mm-hmm. And that goes for the analyst as well. Analysts take their patients with them, as it were, to conferences in hotels, to home offices, to their consulting rooms outside their home, to kitchens, to living rooms. And of course, patients do the same. And so there is not the reliable, containing, dependable repetition that we supply when a patient comes to our consulting room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the questions you ask critically is, should we change our way of working in the way in which we have? Meaning, should we actually agree to be on tap? I kept writing on tap. Mm-hmm. The analyst is on tap. The analyst is in her pocket. The analyst can be, you know, the fantasy that there's no separation. I mean, Winnicott mm-hmm. writes, incomplete adaptation to need makes objects real, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So yep. Somehow, you know, with these screen relations, you know, what is the fate of psychoanalysis, which very much so needs a beginning, you know, a birth and a death every session.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because I don't know if you remember, but one of the patients that I interviewed mm-hmm. she said leaving the Skype session with a click of the mouse was like having a cesarean instead of a natural birth.
Right.
You know, firstly, I think that what you're talking about is contained within a larger issue in culture, in our culture now, which is that we are always on and always connected, and that as a culture, we're not learning to negotiate solitude. We're not learning to negotiate separation or frustration, because right. everything is instantaneous. Mm-hmm. And obviously, these are things that people who are experts in the communications and technology field, like Sherry Turkle and Nicholas Carr, write mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. And because psychoanalysis is part of culture, this is, of course, happening within technologically mediated treatments as well. Right. The patients that I interviewed talked a lot about the difficulty, for instance, that they felt in not moving in space to get to a session, that the instantaneousness of the connection, in fact, was problematic for them. Mm-hmm. And the analysts also talked about the difficulty in fact, not digesting their sessions in the same way that, and the patients said the same, that it was a difficult thing to remember, to process when the connection was simply made by a click of the mouse. And in thinking about this, you know, obviously issues of separation, of bearing separation, of saying goodbye for perhaps to your analyst or your patient who needs to move, mm-hmm. And working through that move instead of hanging on to that person.
Right.
These are all issues that come to the fore. But even more simply, in terms of going back to the idea of the body, when you don't move in space mm-hmm. To get somewhere, when you don't have that transition, it actually affects, I think, the experience of the session. And recently, the people who won the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine did some very interesting research right. in cells in the hippocampus that help you to navigate, to find your way through space, and how these, in fact, are being changed by people using GPSs, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things they found is that those cells are also involved in memory.
Mm-hmm.
so that as you move through space, or as you move your hand as you write, for instance, mm-hmm. that also activates cells, your memory cells, your neural network in the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. And so I think that goes some way to explaining why we as analysts found it difficult to remember sessions, and why the patients I talked to found it so hard to leave a session and not move in space, mm-hmm. And digest that session.
Mm-hmm. Right, with just a little click, mm-hmm. and you're gone. And it's always a moment of waiting. I always let the patient click first. Click off and say goodbye first. I mean, that's sort of, I've noticed that in myself, you know, and I was like, well, that's so interesting, mm-hmm. as a way to allow them to decide. Okay, and you know, I'll say, okay, we're out of time. And then I wait for them to, you know, you hear that funny noise, mm-hmm. and they're gone first. On the rare occasion though, that I have clicked off first, you know, thinking I heard them click off, I shudder. Right. I'm like, oh boy, you know, I always see myself as I'm still in the room. The patient leaves me and comes back, right? They leave me and they come back. But when I've mm-hmm. shut off the Skype or whatever first, I thought, oh my God, did the patient notice? Well, no one's ever noticed, you know, it's like as if, I mean, if I had gotten up and said, okay, time to leave and push the patient more out of the room, I mean, it's quite strange. We're not thinking about it, I guess, as a culture. So we aren't. It's not surprising that our patients aren't noticing if we hang up first.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And of course, when it's not noticed, then there isn't any possibility of discussing it. Mm-hmm. So you know what could save that would be if it were grist for the mill. But if it's impossible to actually put your finger on and mm-hmm. to discuss, then it can't be. It can't be brought into the session.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the things that comes out in the book also is that, you know, perhaps we have via Skype, we have the death of reverie, because you point out in the book that without, and this is a quote, without focused attention, using the screen, sense of presence cannot be maintained. So much for evenly hovering, you know, attention, mm-hmm. right? It's you're zeroing in. To try and capture as much as you can from what the patient is conveying. And yet, I think it's Todd Essig, you quote, says something along these lines. And for people who don't know, Todd Essig also writes on some of these, the subject matter. And Dr. Isaacs Russell and Essig are I believe, close colleagues. But I'm just thinking about... you know, if we lose this free-floating approach, and instead what we're gathering, according to Essig, I think is data. We're getting data on the patient. But data does not an analysis make, right?
Right. You know, you're gathering more information, mm-hmm. but it does affect reverie. It's interesting because, in fact, what the informatics people say is that if you have to concentrate with effort, that actually decreases your sense of presence. Mm-hmm. So that it's the effortlessness that increases your sense of presence, mm-hmm. even if it's the illusion of telepresence. And the fact is that, as one person I interviewed said, she felt glued to the screen. That there is a tremendous effort to concentrate because of the less rich and less easy way of communicating. And that is the inverse of reverie, absolutely the opposite. And I think that if you think about it in terms of the way that Alan Shore thinks about right brain and left brain, mm-hmm. that your right brain is this much more global perceiver, whereas your left brain is this narrowly focused perceiver, and that is what we do when we're using the screen. We're mm-hmm. focusing in, which really takes away our opportunity for reverie, for having clinical intuition. Probably also one of the reasons why, if you have to do it, you personally don't like using the video of the screen. You prefer just using the audio.
Yeah, I was thinking about. I think there's in the book maybe something about the analyst who is. dress from the waist up, but in but below the waist, they're in their pajamas or something
Yes.
like that, right?
Yes.
And you know, and I've joked around like with you know interviewees on New Books and Psychoanalysis, like you can be in your pajamas because we're it's not video, nobody's going to see you, right? And and perhaps that's because I do interviews, I tend to do them on a day when I'm not seeing patients, so I you know am in my house and in my pajamas if I want to be or you know whatever it is, but then you know. The question arises, you know, the frame, the analytic frame is, we discuss it as analysts, is it's for the patient, right? It's for the patient, the frame is for the patient, study their resistances, blah, 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 blah. But really what we're seeing is that the analyst loses her frame. What's the analyst's frame for doing this work when we can work remotely?
Yes, and that was one thing that we didn't anticipate when I was speaking with this peer group. You know, we thought that we would be conducting our sessions as we always did, and we didn't. And it was sort of like, you know, why do you climb the mountain? Because it's there. Well, why do you use Skype the way you do? Because you can. And as I did say in the book, I think there is something a bit transgressive, a bit sort of daring and pushing the boundaries for us when we do that. It is a tremendous labor. It's really hard to do the job we do, which is probably one of the reasons why we do it in 50-minute bites, because you couldn't do it much longer than that at a time. Right. And I think that we have a lot of giving up of easy things. Our time, our schedules in our lives are very rigorous. It's hard, as Winnicott said, to be more reliable than you are in real life. And so if you can wear your pajama bottoms or bring in your cup of tea or whatever during a session, I think that it's a bit of a breaking away from a rebellion from the very strict way that we have been taught and experienced psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really see that. In fact, I had a couple session this morning via Skype, and I was thinking very much, I don't know how perfect, you know, that I have this session, and the only time we can work it out is when I have my computer and I'm at home, and you know, because my office doesn't have Wi-Fi, blah blah blah. And I was getting dressed and putting on my makeup, and which I do every morning before I go to work. I put on my makeup, you know, and et cetera. But I'm doing that, and then I realize that I'm going to be on a screen and having, you know, been sort of steeped in your text. And wouldn't you know it, the one member of this couple says to me, "Oh wow, your makeup looks really great." I said, geez, you know, that is there, but there's something about it being on a screen as if I'm on television, you know,
yes,
versus a patient commenting on, you know, how they see, they, you know, they think we look that particular day. I was like, oh, she caught me. I was preparing for my close-up.
I think there is a question, you know, about how it feels to be on the screen. You know, are we preparing for a close-up? Are we psychoanalysts simulating psychoanalysis by being on the screen? And I do think that that it's worth thinking about as one approaches using something like Skype, using mediation for treatment, because it really changes the feeling in the room.
Right. Right. Let's talk for a minute about, I was interested in the, we may get sort of that, the weird Skype eye contact, which is never eye contact, right? It's not, it's eye almost, it's a person alone. I think you write, did you write about your daughter or was this a quote?
It was Sherry Turkle's quote. Turkle. She said that she talked to her daughter and that because you can't make eye contact, her daughter looked like she was a person alone.
Mm-hmm. So there we are. We're in front of the screen. I mean, you know, we have a little box with ourselves on the bottom right or the top right or wherever it is. So we can sort of watch ourselves as we watch the patient. This is, you know, it's like a three-ring circus. of distraction.
Yes, it is. You, even though with some programs you can disable that,
Right.
you can't help checking, you can't help seeing it for a moment before you disable it.
Right.
And so you are very aware of how you look. And I wrote in the book about how one never knows how this is being used, because it's not only our own awareness of how we may appear and the distraction of that, but one analyst told me the story of a patient who, it turned out, for the first year of an analysis, was looking at himself as the big picture, was talking to himself, and the analyst never knew that. So again, when you don't share an environment, you really don't know what the other person is doing.
Right, right. That's an incredible story in the book, actually. When she finds that out, it's like, he's been looking at himself. Here I was. I thought he was at least looking at me. Now, what about, okay, so patient is using the couch. You're on Skype. You know, all of my patients are using the couch if they're on Skype, and they set up their computer. And the strange thing is, you know, my chair is behind the couch in my office. But in Skype, the patient often sets up the, you know, the camera to show me their profile as they lie down. I haven't given it much thought, but I'm like, well, this is just so strange. What am I seeing in watching this? And I don't know. I wanted to talk to you about, you know, with Skype, we have the fantasy of eye contact. In analysis, we often don't have much eye contact if the patient is on the couch through the bulk of the session. And yet there's a difference. Can you talk to us about what is that difference?
The difference between what happens, for instance, when you're seeing a patient who's on the couch via Skype and also co-presently, the difference between that?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's a tremendous difference, because even though you don't have eye contact, there are many, many ways of communicating when two bodies share a room together. That don't comprise eye contact, and that does not get communicated via the screen. And so even if you're not having eye contact at that moment, and of course there is peripheral vision, and there you do see the patient when they come in and when they leave, you still are missing really quite nuanced communication, and some of which I think we haven't even charted yet. We don't actually know how this communication works. People have mentioned all sorts of psychobiological, very, very subtle things like pheromones. And none of this is happening. So that when a patient uses a couch via the screen, I think it's a very different thing. It is a very different experience. You know, this idea that somehow if you can see someone, or if you can see and hear someone, that's enough, has been discussed by a woman that I interviewed for my book, named Maria Solano, who is a trainee psychoanalyst and therefore is a patient and a therapist, and she is blind, and she is emphatic that being in the room with her patients and with her analyst is quite different in terms of her experience of presence than when she is on the telephone or on Skype, even though in both cases she can't see them.
Right. That's fascinating.
You know, the research that I told you about with the navigation and there's been an elaboration on that, which is fascinating. It's been done by some scientists at UCLA just recently. And they're doing it because they're really interested in perfecting virtual reality. Sure. And they're interested in how the brain perceives experiences in virtual reality. And what they did was they set up a very immersive virtual environment and the equivalent real environment, and they put rats in both the real and the virtual environment. And what they found was that in the real environment, there was an increase in the neurons that were firing as they maneuvered through the environment. But in the virtual environment, the rat, which looked exactly like the real room, the rats actually seemed to behave perfectly normally. They negotiated both environments exactly the same. But in the virtual world, the rat's neurons fired completely randomly, as if they had no idea where the rat was. And although the neurons were highly active in the real world environment, more than half the neurons shut down in virtual space. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm bringing this up it is, and by the way, rats, the way rats work in terms of navigating space is very similar to human beings, which is why they use the rats. But I'm bringing this up because we don't know how we perceive that which is around us. We don't have enough information yet. And so to deprive ourselves of that when we know that we work in a field which is based in relationship, mm-hmm. which is based in people being alongside people, and which grows from the mother-infant relationship, mm-hmm. you know, we don't know what happens when we separate them by a screen. I do know that mothers and infants can't function when separated by screens.
Right. Well, what about, it just came to mind, I was thinking about studies I'm sure have been done on people who use a lot of pornography on the screen. And is there, you know, I don't know the research, but I believe that it's out there, right? So, you know, and, you know, I've treated a couple of patients who seem to be sort of deadened their live with another human being sex life as they were using and viewing more and more pornography on the screen. There was a, and I guess I, seeing that the oldest profession is prostitution and psychoanalysis sometimes bears a resemblance to it. I'm just thinking about this, that, you know, what people can have sex and orgasm, right? Looking at each other on the screen. There is something that happens in, you know, bodily, right? That does take place when people, you know, have, you know, Skype sex, right? As, you know, people talk about. So the body comes alive in a certain way, but yet when it comes to the analytic process, the body is not being, you know, since the analyst is not having sex with the patient, right? It's like the patient's body is gone unattended to. But I think that I'd be curious if you know about any of the research on the use of pornography on the screen and the impact on.
Well, Todd Essig has actually written some good stuff on that.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess what it makes me think about is, you know, when you have an orgasm, you know, why do you have an orgasm? And one of the things that's happening, even though sex can be fully interactive on the screen, is that two people are making this experience exclusive of each other. Mm-hmm. And that really brings to mind, again, this idea that Winnicott talks about, that unless the object is not protected, the subject never places the object outside and can never do more than experience a kind of self-analysis using the analyst as a projection of a part of the self. And I would guess that that's what's happening in a sexual encounter on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just interesting to think about that. What's lost? What is possible? You raise an issue for psychoanalysis, for the profession of psychoanalysis, and I'm going to read a quote of yours here. I call it the McDonald's metaphor in my notes. If we accept that technologically mediated treatment, this is you writing, is experimental and unproved with limitations as compared to co-present treatment, then it is akin to marketing a fine dining experience. And because people want fast food, opening a McDonald's, because if you don't, someone else will. So the question comes to mind is, this is a really old-fashioned binary question, but is it, you know, that everyone's, what makes something a psychoanalysis? But if it's done on the screen, is it a psychoanalysis? I mean, you know, should analysts, instead of saying, okay, four times a week, you know, the IPA, the APA, whatever, I mean, all these different, you know, four times a week makes it an analysis, you know, use of the couch makes it an analysis. And I found myself wondering, at the end of the book, I was like, okay, maybe I should cancel all these Skype sessions, because I'm more convinced that this is, you know, the devil's work, right, than doing what I most enjoy doing, which is working with the patient in the room. I wonder, do you have any thoughts about should the profession be taking a stand?
That's a really good question. I'm glad you've given me the opportunity to comment on it, because, yeah, you know, I want to emphasize that.
Uh-oh, I think we're having a technological problem. Hold on.
Okay.
Can you hear that?
No.
Oh, dear. I hear it. I don't know what's causing it. This is an example of what can what can happen. Hold on,
do you hear a noise?
Yeah, I do. It's like a it's a strange noise, like a reverberation. Hold on. I don't know what it is. Well, I think we're gonna have to, you're gonna have to talk over it. This is just an example of what you deal with.
Since I don't hear it, I don't know whether you're recording it or not.
Would there be a virtual ringing back? Yeah, there's some feedback. Hold on. Okay.
Are you there?
It's, you know what? It's giving us. Can you believe this? I can hear you thrice. It says, "Are you there? Are you there? Are you there?"
That's interesting. Do you want to try to join back?
Oh dear. But why don't you? We're almost done with the interview, so why don't you answer the question? And you know, this is what we contend with.
Right. Well, I think what's really
much
important.
Better.
Can you hear?
Oh yeah, perfect now.
Okay. I think what's really important is that I actually do some treatment on Skype, and I feel that what's really important is not that this is the devil's work. I'm not saying that at all. But that we must have a dialogue about it. Mm-hmm. And that if we are going to use technology to help us in a positive way, rather than letting it run us, mm-hmm. That we need to be really clear about the gains and losses in using technology. So there are some times when being able to use Skype for treatment is invaluable, when someone is without any other form of treatment, when someone is ill for a long time and needs treatment, when someone does have to travel and so sees you in person some of the time, which has lots of implications in terms of memory and refreshing memory. Mm-hmm. So I think what's really important is that we need to keep a dialogue going about the gains and the losses, rather than sleepwalking into using technology. And, you know, when we talk about the McDonald's idea, there is a huge economic incentive to use technology. It's cheaper. You can have a bigger network of patients, a catchment area that way. You don't necessarily have to have an overhead of your office. And I think we really need to think about that. And I just want to add that what I'm very interested in is that when I have spoken about this in a very balanced way, inviting dialogue, and Sherry Turkle told me this was her experience speaking at APSA recently as a keynote speaker as well, mm-hmm. the subject engenders really vehement response from psychoanalysts and psychotherapists, and I'm really interested in that. I'm interested in why the dialogue about the gains and the losses, mm-hmm. and the particular research that's already been done is responded to as if people are putting their hands over their ears and saying, no, I'm not listening to you.
I don't like what I'm hearing, so mm-hmm. I'm not hearing it, right?
Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm saying is, no, I'm not saying it's the devil's work. I think that it can be very useful at times. But I also think that we need to know how it affects the way we practice. We need to know how it affects our patients. And importantly, we need to let our patients know that it's an experimental medium, and that this has implications for informed consent.
No doubt. I would also add to that, and what is the impact on the analyst?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to, for those analysts who, you know, there are those that do prefer to work this way, right? There is perhaps it gives them a kind of a coating or a veneer of, you know, they can't be, killed off, in effigy. So it does provide a certain amount of insulation.
And freedom.
Yeah, and freedom, right, to be in your PJs.
Or to travel, you know, to live in different places. That's something that simply needs to be discussed. It needs to be thought about.
Right.
And until we can do that, what's going to happen is that technology is going to be leading us rather than our using technology in a way that actually truly benefits us rather than diminishes and degrades our relationships in all forms, whether it's, you know, using in treatment or communicating with our loved ones. Whatever.
Right. I mean, the medium is the message. You know, there is human agency, and what is it? We created this. It satisfies something in us, and it does something to us. But also, you know, just like early television research, or like think about the Frankfurt School, you know, and the idea that, you know, this bad jazz from Columbia Records is going to ruin our ability to appreciate good jazz. The answer, as you're saying, is definitely much more complicated than, you know, what Theodore Adorno thought about jazz. I mean, his worst essay ever, I think. But, you know, it is much more complicated. When I say it's the devil's work, it's just because I tend toward hyperbole. It's
but, you know, there are people who don't tend toward hyperbole who, you know, on both sides are very extreme. And I think that, that you know, perhaps it's worth everybody talking rather than feeling it's impossible to have a dialogue.
Right. And the degree to which psychoanalysts feel themselves under threat, and I'll do anything I can to get patients. And, you know, listen, I mean, we can create, you know, you make yourself a little more scarce and you really increase desire.
My stepson, who is so wired in and so adept at using all of his technology, said to me very sweetly a few weeks ago, you know, he said, if everybody is going to start using technology for treatment, you know what's going to happen? Being in the same room with someone is going to become so much more valuable.
And I think he makes a good point that many analysts, you know, might need to hear in order to tolerate thinking through the entirety of the implications of using technology for treatment. So we're going to have to stop for today. This has been a delight, and I think many people are going to be, you know, fascinated by the points that were raised today and that are further elaborated in the book. So I wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk with us at New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Thank you, Tracy. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. And to all the listeners, stay tuned. I believe Christopher Bolas's book will be our perhaps next interview. It's on schizophrenia. And his thoughts about that. So stay tuned, and thanks to all for listening. Bye-bye.